Mr. Phil Dunnigan passed along to me, I got it on email this morning, an announcement for all of the people in the Pacific Northwest or in British Columbia, whoever might be interested in whatever part of the country, if they want to travel all the way to beautiful Lake Tahoe. He said there have been numerous requests from brethren needing additional information about obtaining lodging at our Lake Tahoe Peace Site. Chris Cumming and his website team have recently added a special section on obtaining lodging there, along with maps on the church website. And you know it's coginterlink.org, which is the Church of God Interlink.org, is what it stands for. Church of God, or the Intercontinental Church of God, spelled backwards, whatever. Coginterlink.org. This special section should give you all the information you want to obtain lodging at Tahoe. If you don't have a computer, there may be someone in your area who could print it out off of their computer for you. Also, all of the U.S. feast sites are having a raffle event, which has become so popular with the brethren. The raffles are fun, and the proceeds are used to simply help finance some of the activities at the feast. Many of us have some fond keepsakes that we have brought home from the feast, one at the raffle. They talked me into giving one of my paintings for each one of them, and I'm frantically trying to retouch and finish up some that have been sitting out in my garage for quite a while. Still got that to do. For those who would like to contribute to the raffle, there is no end to the list of items you can bring. Popular items in the past have been handcrafted items, stuffed animals, paintings, fishing equipment, tools, books. No end to possibilities. It's a way to contribute some items that will make someone a little happier at the feast. I still remember the look on a young girl's face who won a fishing rod. Hope everything is going well with you down there, etc. And of course he had said that he's very happy that Stan and Judy and their family are coming back up to Tahoe again. Because otherwise he would have been without a song leader, and they needed an extra minister up there because they had a very few of them. And so Stan will be speaking to the brethren up at Tahoe again. I know he wanted to go to one of the other feast sites maybe next year. We'll certainly make sure you get to do that. Just how limited do you think God's power is? Now, that's a trick question, isn't it? If you say, well, I'm not sure he can do this or that. But when you look at people in their day-to-day relationship with God, with His Word, with the Bible, and with the way they face problems in life, you would begin to assume that it's very, very limited. The more people who gang up on God, the more possibility you have that He will listen, for example. People think that they fast and look poor and to get God's attention, as we read recently in the 58th chapter of Isaiah. And when certain things come along, such as some death-dealing disease that men don't know what to do about, the worst news that anyone can hear is when the doctor comes out after looking at the biopsy and says, I'm sorry, only God can save him now. Then a wail of, oh no, it's all over. When they hear that, it's like a death sentence, isn't it? Because instead of saying, well, that was true from the beginning, and I know that God is perfectly able to save him and to heal him, that's the worst news the relatives could ever hear. Is this work of God, which is quite limited right now, intended to be forever small and limited? I'll tell you, it is a work of faith, and I'll tell you why, because only a few days ago we had $100,000 in the bank, and a few days later we had $60,000. Now it's back to about $75,000. Now that's all financial information I'm going to give you right now, but it shows you that if you were operating a business and you were on a roller coaster like dropping 40% in 3 days, you would get a little nervous if you were merely thinking about marketing some product, or you're thinking about the economy, rather than thinking about trust in God and knowing that Monday morning that post office box is going to be filled with letters, and that many of them are going to have checks in them from God's people who are supporting the work. So with courage and faith, we go ahead and sign about a $22,500 check for WGN, and we have managed so far never to have to sit on or hold checks. We don't keep them for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. We paid all our bills on time. Our credit is good, and it is truly a work of faith. Just before the feast last year, we were down below $20,000. And when you've got bills coming along that are more than that, you're in a pretty precarious situation. We went to the feast in full confidence. We knew that the holy day offerings on atonement and the first day of the feast and the last great day would offset it, and they did. We came right back up. And this year we can say that God is blessing us because we have a good bit more in the bank this year prior to the feast than we did last year. It takes more than courage. It takes some of the synonyms of courage, but it takes faith to be in a work like this and to know that it's going to grow, that it's going to have a great impact, that it's going to have great fruit and great results. How much courage do we possess when the problems of life come along, such as sickness, financial reversals, problems with our children, problems in our marriages, problems with neighbors and other people, family problems, all kinds of difficulties, and most of us, of course, it is sickness and disease and problems in school with children. In this rotten, filthy society around us right now, they decided to send around again the movie called The Exorcist. Information came to me the other day that the Pope had allegedly tried to exorcise a person who was reputedly demon-possessed, and he failed to do so. The Exorcist was a movie about, I think, things like that, some kind of a priest or a preacher trying to cast a demon out of a young girl or someone who was demon-possessed. Well, Hollywood is all gaga about it. I was seeing it on the internet the other day, bigger, badder than ever. They've interviewed this young girl who is now a woman, grown up, and they put her on the major programs on the networks, and they're all excited about it. A rotten, filthy movie which is putting into people's minds demonism, Satanism, and demon possession. At the same time, Harry Potter's books that I've talked about are the rave of all of the NEA, the National Educational Association, the teachers of this country. And it's being taught in classrooms across the country. People were snapping up. There were long lines waiting for the books to come in and be delivered. All of a sudden, the nation is a sea in a wave of Satanism and demonism. You have to withstand all of these things around you, continually have to have the courage to face problems like that. Sometimes people need the courage that they can read in James 4:7, resist the devil and he will flee from you. But oftentimes we quail in fear before physical reversals, not just spiritual ones. I took the trouble to look up the word courage again. Courage is the quality of mind that enables one to meet danger without fear. Fearlessness, to have the courage of one's convictions, to act as one believes he should. If you look up courageous, that was a British ship, by the way, you will find dauntless, and that was a Douglas dive bomber, by the way. Intrepid, that was a British ship and also a man called Intrepid. But those are the synonyms: dauntless, intrepid, valorous, daring, bold, plucky, brave, hardy, steady. Courage in the face of danger. During World War II, there were many people who gave their lives for their buddies. I think you've read of cases like that, where men in a foxhole in one of the islands of the South Pacific, a Japanese grenade would come tumbling in, and there they were with their guns and ammunition. All of a sudden, there was a live grenade sputtering in the midst of them, and a man would fling himself on the grenade and take the full blast right in his chest, which would kill him instantly, in order to save his buddies. Most heroes, including Audie Murphy, who was America's most decorated soldier during World War II, would tell you that heroism is oftentimes fear in action. That men are afraid, guess what, to let their buddies down. The buddy system of a man wanting to appear as courageous and as fearless as the people around him and depending upon them to do the same for him. There are an awful lot of people who have actually given their lives because they didn't want to be ashamed or embarrassed. They didn't want to let their buddies down. It was a kind of a gang, a community, a group-related experience. They were so attached to them, and oftentimes the buddy system was deliberately exploited by people in the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Corps. And of course, that is done even in some of the little clubs, the buddy system. Each person has another buddy right there. He takes care of the one takes care of the other when they're going through an obstacle course or out in the jungles eating snakes or whatever it is. And they watch out for each other. And it says in God's Word, we're to bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Well, how limited is the power of God? And how small, how weak, how unnoticed, how inferior, how inept, how divided, how confused, how utterly ineffective is God's church supposed to be? Because right now, that is a description of about 250 different groups. I don't need to name any of them, but how effective are they as a sum total in comparison with the work that was done from 1957 until 1978? How effective are all of them put together? Are all of them put together reaching 30 million Americans per week with a message of witness and warning? Do all of them together have a mailing list of 5 million with a magazine that is sent free of charge once a month and has thousands and thousands on newsstands in airports all over the country? No. Not all of them in the aggregate are doing anything close to that. Is that something that ought to be done? You know, Jesus said, "Fear not, little flock." And I've quoted that time and again. I've even said it sometimes when people are absent on vacation or home because they're sick. And I will say, "Greetings, little flock." I remember one time, and what a shock it was to me, because very shortly, and it may have been the very first, quote, personal appearance campaign that I ever went to in early 1978, after I had moved to Tyler, Texas, after having been the executive vice president of the Worldwide Church of God and president of Ambassador College. And the previous feast, I had spoken to, I don't know whether 150,000 people in the aggregate, but 12,000 here and 15,000 there and 8,000 the other place, 11 sites in 8 days, and I'd spoken to every one of them. Well, we flew my own private airplane at 310 down to Birmingham, Alabama, and it proved to be one of these dark, lowering, cloudy, thunderstorm, kind of a horrible night. It was cool. It was in the winter. We went to a motel meeting room, probably about this size. And lo and behold, when I walked in, there were 15 people there. I stood there and opened my Bible and delivered a sermon just as if they were 5,000. I won't tell you what was going on inside my mind and heart, but I said, "I've got to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to see this through. I will not short shrift these people. I will not let them for one moment see that I'm disappointed with the number who are here. And I want to tell you why from God's Word and from the Bible." I've told people before about the old song, "Stout-Hearted Men." Give me some men who were stout-hearted men, and I'll soon give you 10,000 more. Start me with 10 who were stout-hearted men, and I'll soon give you 10,000 more. Let's turn to the book of Joshua. You know that Joshua was the young man who led Israel after Moses died, and Joshua is like a type of Jesus Christ. Joshua leading the new generation of Israelites across the River Jordan into the Promised Land is a type of Christ who is our forerunner entering into the kingdom for us and overcoming and conquering all the enemies that lie in the way. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Eternal, it came to pass that the Eternal spoke unto Joshua. Some people prefer the soft sound, Joshua. I think Joshua is indicated, but nevertheless, whatever. The son of Nun, he was the son of one, but his name was Nun. Moses' minister, saying, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, unto the land which I do give to them, even the children of Israel." I might skip ahead a little bit and tell you right quickly that in the fifth chapter, it says, "For the children of Israel, verse 6, walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people that were men of war, which came out of Egypt, were consumed, because they obeyed not the voice of the Eternal, unto whom the Lord sware that he would not show them the land which the Lord sware to give unto their fathers, that he would give us, a land that flows with milk and honey, and their children, whom he raised up in their stead, them Joshua circumcised." It was a huge, big national circumcision, and that is in the fifth chapter. You can read about that. And they camped in a place called Gilgal, which meant a rolling hill, and it took a while for them all to be healed. Now, going back to the first chapter, verse 3, "Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given to you, as I said unto Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, even unto the great river, the river Euphrates, and all the land of the Hittites." So it was all the way to the river which now is the border between Iraq and Iran. This was a huge piece of territory in the Middle East, not just little tiny Israel, but all the way to the Euphrates River. And under the great sea, that is the Mediterranean, toward the going down of the sun, shall be your coast. There shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life, meaning stand up against you like Korah tried. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee, and I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. Now Jesus Christ said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. But time and time again in our lives, we will get all petulant, and we'll get all tremble-chinned, and we'll begin to find our little chins quivering and tears in our eyes, and we'll say, I think God has left me. I don't think God loves me anymore. It's just like God can't do it this time. It's some little picky deal, just almost nothing in its real consequences, and people will get all upset, I think God is not with me anymore. And you'll have to try to settle them down and explain, well, of course, because God said he would never leave us nor forsake us. Now, how much good did that do Joshua? Did that immediately put a steel rod where his spinal column used to be? Did that give him a steel jaw and an iron will? Well, we'll see. I will be with thee. I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. Be strong and of a good courage. Now, he's telling him this, and he says it more than once. For unto this people shall you divide for an inheritance the land which I swear unto their fathers to give them. Only be thou strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do all according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. So it is conditional. You'd better keep the law. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left. You don't deviate. You continue straight ahead, one foot right after the other, and you observe the law. That you may prosper whithersoever you go. That was the condition. You observe the law, the result is you're going to be successful. You're going to prosper. Your enemies will fall before you. This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate therein day and night, that you may observe to do all according to all that is written therein, for then you shall make your way prosperous, and then you shall have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of a good courage, and be not afraid, neither be you dismayed, for the Eternal your God is with thee whithersoever thou goest. Tremendous, strengthening, courageous statement. It should have given Joshua all of the courage that he needed. So Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the host, and command the people, saying, prepare you victuals, for within 3 days you shall pass over this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Eternal your God gives you to possess it. And of the Reubenites, the Gadites, half of the tribe of Manasseh, spake Joshua, saying, remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Eternal, commanded you, saying, the Lord your God has given you rest and has given you this land. You can find reference to this back in the book of Hebrews, the 4th chapter, and how the promised land is a symbol of rest, the millennial rest, as well as the fact that this oration was delivered on the Sabbath, apparently, or at least 3 days before the Sabbath when they walked dry shod across the Jordan River. Your wives, your little ones, and your cattle shall remain in the land which Moses gave you on this side Jordan, but you shall pass before your brethren armed. He's now talking to the army that has suddenly been raised. All the mighty men of valor, and help them, until the Eternal has given your brethren rest, as he has given you, and they also have possessed the land which the Eternal your God giveth them. Then you shall return into the land of your possession, and enjoy it, which Moses, the Eternal servant, gave you on this side Jordan toward the sun rising. And they answered Joshua. It's interesting. They must have overheard, they must have known, or they must have merely said, because God put it in their mind to say the very same thing. All that you command us, we will do. And whithersoever you send us, we will go. According as we hearken unto Moses in all things, but their parents didn't, so will we hearken unto thee. Only the Eternal thy God be with thee, as he was with Moses. Whithersoever he be that doeth rebel, or doth rebel against your commandment, and will not hearken unto your words and all that you command him, only be strong and of a good courage. He says if somebody rebels, he'll be put to death. But Joshua, be strong and of a good courage. Now that's the army telling him that. God tells him that 3 times. Now this army that he's raised says, be strong, you're our leader. Be of good courage. We want to follow a courageous and a strong leader. I won't read all of the spying out of the land and about Rahab and all the rest of it, but chapter 3, Joshua said, verse 10, when he called all the children of Israel together, "Hereby you shall know that the living God is among you, that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites," who had the city which was named after them, Jebus, and after the Israelites took it, it was called Jebus Shalom, or Jerusalem as it is today, and Jerusalem was their major city. "Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth passes over before you into Jordan. Now therefore take you 12 men out of the tribes of Israel, out of every man, every tribe a man, and it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the ark of the Eternal, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of Jordan, that the waters of Jordan shall be cut off from the waters that come down from above, and they shall stand upon an heap." So you have them crossing over the Red Sea dry shod into the land of Sinai, and you have them crossing over Jordan dry shod. The minute the priests began to get ankle deep, the waters stopped and ebbed, and there was nothing left, and the water began to back up just like a giant dam had dammed it and overflowed the land behind it, and they walked across dry shod. It came to pass, when the people removed from their tents to pass over Jordan, and the priests bearing the ark of the covenant before the people, and as they bear the ark that were come unto Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the ark were dipped in the brim of the water, for Jordan overflows all his banks in the time of harvest, in the fall, and the snows had melted on Hermon, that the waters which came down from above stood and rose upon an heap very far from the city Adam, which is beside Zaratan, and I don't think they've ever found where that is, they don't even know. And those that came down toward the Sea of the Plain, even the Salt Sea, failed and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. So they passed over just barely before the Jordan empties into the Red Sea, because the ancient city of Jericho had been rebuilt out of the rubble, and it's there today. Not the ancient city, a totally different city, but you can go to Jericho. Now over in chapter 4, "It came to pass, when all the people were clean passed over Jordan, that the Eternal spake unto Joshua, saying, Take you 12 men out of the people, out of every tribe of man, and command you them, saying, Take you hence out of the midst of Jordan, out of the place where the priest's feet stood firm, 12 stones. And you shall carry them over with you, and leave them in the lodging place where you shall lodge this night." There were two different groups of 12 stones that were set up. Joshua set up 12 stones in the middle of the riverbed. But the priests were to carry them on their shoulders, big heavy stones, and walk completely across into the promised land. And where they camped that night, they were to set them up. Then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had prepared of the children of Israel out of every tribe of man, and said, "Pass over before the ark of the Eternal your God in the midst of Jordan, and take you up every man of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, What mean ye by these stones? Then you shall answer them that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Eternal when it passed over Jordan. The waters of Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be for a memorial unto the children of Israel forever." And the children of Israel did as Joshua commanded. The number 12 is a number of organized beginnings and is a perfect governmental number used in God's Word. 12 tribes, 12 gates into the holy city, 12 disciples, 12 apostles. That's why they had to cast the lot so that Matthias would replace Judas Iscariot. So Christ began with a perfect governmental number in his church, 12 apostles. So the children of Israel did as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones out of the midst of Jordan, as the Eternal spake unto Joshua, according to the number of the tribes, and carried them over to the place where they lodged, and laid them down there. A little later on you can read, I won't read all the way through that, about how Joshua then set up 12 stones in the midst of Jordan, well, it's just the next verse, in the place where the feet of the priests which bear the Ark of the Covenant stood, and they are there unto this day. Depending upon how big they were and of what material they are or were made, they might still be there to this day. You could go over there and look along in the bed of the Jordan River and probably find them. I would doubt that over all of these many, many years of erosion, but it's a possibility. All right, about 40,000, verse 13, prepared for war, passed over before the Eternal to battle to the plains of Jericho. On that day, the Eternal magnified Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they feared him as they feared Moses all the days of his life. And why not? They'd seen a fabulous miracle. Rivers don't just dry up. You don't walk by and see a giant wall of water up on one side and an empty riverbed on the other side. And by the time they had encircled, of course, Jericho, and the walls came down, and that was the first obstacle in their way, which they had overcome, then they really began to understand what kind of a leader Joshua was. Let's go to Judges. The book of Judges, one of the bloodiest books in all of the Bible, and it is, by its title, what it stands for, which is a period of time when God raised up. Some of them were perverse, and some of them left the way of God, and some of them were good and effected reforms, but a series of judges to rule over Israel. Chapter 6, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. And because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains and caves and strongholds. They're dispersed like refugees all over the countryside, and the Midianites have the best land, and they are there with their camels and their herds, and they're taking the best of everything, and ravaging, pillaging, burning, raping, where it suited them, the Israelites. And so it was when Israel had sown, they'd gone out and eked out a little patch of ground and planted some seed, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites, and the children of the east, even they came up against them. These are all Arabic nations. Remember that Moses married a Midianitish princess. And so their son, Gershon, was actually a mixed breed, but nevertheless, through that lineage came Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Also remember, too, that Rebekah was an Hittitess and had married Uriah the Hittite. And either she was Jewish and there was an interracial marriage allowed then, or she was in Hittitess, which is more logical, and David married her, and through David and Rebecca came Solomon, and so in the lineage of Jesus Christ. They encamped against them, verse 4, and destroyed the increase of the earth, till you come unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass. And they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude, for both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites. Well, they cry to God, verse 7. And God sent a prophet, which says, Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up out of Egypt, forth of the house of bondage, delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the land of all that oppressed you, and drave them out from before you, and gave you their land. And I said, I am the Lord your God. Fear not the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. They'd gone into idolatry. They'd begun to sacrifice to pagan gods to curry their favors, if they existed. There came an angel of the Eternal, which sat under an oak, which was in Ophrah. This is where famous talk show host gets her name. It's actually a place, not a person, but probably, well, never mind. That pertained to Joash the Abiezrite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. So they were secretly, kind of like the Tennesseans operating a still, the only way they could get away with having food to eat was doing it secretly and hoping that Midianites didn't discover it. The angel of the Eternal appeared unto him and said, The Eternal is with thee, thou mighty man of valor. And Gideon said, O my Lord, if the Lord be with us, why then is all this befallen us? Isn't that exactly what we tend to say oftentimes when we have problems? If God be with us, then how come all these horrible things have happened to us? The angel says, The Eternal is with you. You're a mighty man of valor. Who, me? I'm not valorous. I'm not courageous. I am not strong. I'm not mighty. And where be all his miracles which our father told us about, saying, Did not the Eternal bring us up from Egypt? But now the Eternal has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. And the Eternal looked upon him and said, Go in this thy might, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent thee? Notice that the Eternal said, now maybe it was a messenger because it was an angel of the Lord, verse 12, and I spoke about angels recently, and the word angel means messenger. It may well have been the very individual who became Jesus Christ, because after all, he did appear to many people over a period of time. Have I not sent thee? And he said in him, verse 15, O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? I'm nothing. Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. He was an American. Just kidding, of course, but he was a Manassite. And I believe that the original people that settled here are Manasseh. And so this man was of Manasseh, not Ephraim, but the tribe of Manasseh. And I am the least, meaning the youngest, in my father's house. And the Eternal said unto him, Surely I will be with thee, and you shall smite the Midianites as one man, as if David against Goliath. And he said, If now I have found grace in your sight, then show me a sign that you talk with me. Now that is really stupid when you stop to think about it. I hate to call him stupid, but he was a little dumb at that point. He is hearing the voice. He maybe even is seeing the angel who is standing there before him. Show me a sign that you are talking to me. I'm talking to Tony, and Tony says, Show me a sign that you're talking to me. What are you talking about? Show me a sign that you are talking to me. The fact that you are talking to me is a fact. It is a sign all by itself. But he wants something else, something other than that, to perhaps buttress up or bolster up his sagging courage at this point. Depart not hence, I pray thee, until I come unto thee and bring forth my present. So he went and hurried and made ready a kid and unleavened cakes and almost 9/10 of a bushel of flour, and the flesh he put in a basket and made a big broth, bought it in a pot under the oak and presented it to him. The angel of God, verse 20, said, Take the flesh, the unleavened cakes, and lay them upon this rock and pour out the broth. And he did so. Then the angel of the Eternal put forth the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and there rose up fire out of the rock and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of the Eternal disappeared, departed out of his sight. And when Gideon perceived that he was an angel of the Eternal, we're reading in the narrative that he was, but he wasn't sure apparently until this time, he said, Alas, O Lord God, for because I have seen an angel of the Eternal face to face. And the Eternal said unto him, Peace be unto thee, fear not, you shall not die. Either an audible voice or appeared again, it doesn't say. Then Gideon built an altar there to the Eternal and called it Jehovah Shalom, or peace, God's peace. Unto this day it is yet in Ophrah of the Abiezrites, whoever they were. And it came to pass the same night that the Eternal said unto him, Take your father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old, and throw down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the grove that is by it. And build an altar unto the Eternal, your God, upon the top of this rock, in the ordered place, the margin says a plain or a level place, and take the second bullock and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove which you shall cut down. The grove was an idolatrous grove, probably some of the trees with their roots still in the ground, and they'd carved them as upright pails or symbols, and it was an evil symbol. And so he was to cut them down and actually use them for the wood. Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Eternal had said unto him. And so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city, that he could not do it by day, and he did it by night. Now he has been given a sign. The angel appears to him. He's scared out of his wits. He gives this big offering of meat and meal and everything, sees it burnt up right in front of his eyes. You'd think that would bolster his courage. But instead, he is still afraid. And so he sneaks out there quietly at night and probably tells them, be careful with that axe. Use a saw. Don't make a lot of noise. Let's cut them down, not let anybody know about it. He does it at night where no one else knows about it. When the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was cast down, and the grove was cut down that was by it, and the second bullock was offered upon the altar that was built. So now instead of offering things to pagan idols, you have an actual meat offering to the true God on an altar that had been built on a level, flat place of stone. And they said one another, Who has done this? When they inquired, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. Then the men of the city said to Joash, Bring your son out here that he may die, because he has cast down the altar of Baal, and because he's cut down the grove that was by it. That's sacrilege. You know, idol bashing is a very dangerous pastime. And Joash said unto all that stood against him, Will you plead for Baal? Will you save him? He that will plead for him, let him be put to death while it is yet morning. If he be a god, let him plead for himself. It's a pretty good answer. If he's God, can't he take care of it? Well, it apparently worked, because on that day they called him from that time Jerubbaal, or not Jerubbabel, but Jerubbaal, which means the let the infamous thing contend. Let the despicable or the infamous thing contend for itself. It's a Hebrew expression. And so they use it as a nickname for him, Jerubbaal. He is referred to in that term several times in subsequent chapters. Chapter 7, verse 1, for example, Jerubbaal, who is Gideon, saying, let Baal plead against him because he has thrown down his altar. Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Eternal came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who also was gathered after him, and messengers unto Asher, and Zebulun, and Naphtali. And they came up to meet them. And Gideon said unto God, if you will save Israel by mine hand, as you have said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the floor, the threshing floor, as it should read. And if the dew be on the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the earth beside, then shall I know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. And it was so. He rose up early in the morrow, thrust the fleece together, and wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. But the ground all around is absolutely dry. Now that could only have been an absolute miracle. Gideon said unto God, let not your anger be hot against me, but let me just prove you once more. Isn't this the way a lot of us are sometimes? A lot of times we don't even recognize a miracle when we have it. And a lot of times we don't understand why certain events occur in our lives until we look back a year or two or five later. I want to pause to tell you something personal that is very important to me. I am using a different Bible today. It's almost brand new, but it has an awful lot of markings in it, and it's actually quite old. It's been around a long time. But this Bible was also in a terrible collision one time. It's got a little bit of a watermark on it here, where some kind of water damaged it. And in the overleaf it says, Dear Ted, this Bible has been lost for many years. Leona McNair found it with some of the belongings of one of her sons. Except for some water damage and a few unknown markings and notations, it is the Bible Dick had with him on his final baptismal tour when little Dickie was 8 weeks old. I hope it will serve you well in these last turbulent years ahead of us as you finish the work you've been doing these past 44 years. Love, Lois. And in here is my brother's handwriting that the damage had partially obliterated, Richard D. Armstrong, and his address in Sierra Madre, California, and the genealogy, his marriage to Lois, all of her family, and my family. And I've begun to mark it a little bit. I looked in here, and lo and behold, all kinds of marks that my brother made, because he had this on his lap and was studying it when a car ran headlong into them and smashed him up so bad that it killed him. And I just received this not all that long ago, and I thought, well, since I just about worn out the second Bible of this kind, the National Bible, published in Philadelphia, I'll begin to use my brother Dick's Bible from now on. So I was reading it this morning and reading through some of this, and I read again that overleaf, and I thought I would share that with you. So I've broken out a new and a different Bible now that I'm beginning to mark up. I think about the work of that time, and I think how small it was. When this Bible went through that crash, I was in Springfield, Missouri. There had never been a church there. I was 28 years of age. I was supposed to be there for 6 solid weeks, but my brother's death caused us to cut it down to 4 weeks when my mother and my dad and my sister-in-law, Lois, at that time, came over there on the train for the last Sabbath of 4 weeks of preaching 6 nights a week and going down to KWTO radio station at 6 o'clock every morning and doing the radio program live from there. We had never had a church there before, and after that 4 weeks, we had a church of over 200 that were raised up right then and there as a result of that protracted evangelistic campaign. My dad was there for the very first Sabbath service. I don't know how that Bible ended up in the hands of another person's son that went to Ambassador College, but I'm surely glad that they found it and gave it back to Lois, who sent it to me. So with that little aside, I think of that time and of how small we were at that time and how few churches. We were smaller, or about the same size then, I imagine, as the Intercontinental Church of God is now, and maybe a little smaller, with one difference. We did have a college. We did have some infrastructure. We had some facilities. But God will provide whatever it is we need, and when we need it, He will provide it. Now back to the story at hand. He was going to save Israel with a great army, and so he gathered them together, and of course he asked for the opposite to be true, and the opposite was true, and the next time, behold, it was dry upon the fleece and dew on all the ground, verse 40 of chapter 6. Then Jerubbaal, who was Gideon, and all the people who were with him, rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them, and by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Eternal said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand has saved thee. And they would have done it too. They would have said, look at the great army we raised. Look how powerful we are. Look what we did. Look how great we are. Look at all our great captains and warriors and our great heroes. Now therefore, go on, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead, and there return to the people 22,000. Well, he got rid of all the cowards. That's what he said. They were there, but somewhat reluctantly, and probably couldn't have been depended upon anyway. 22,000 of them said, I'm going home. There remained 10,000. The Eternal said unto Gideon, the people are yet too many. At least the 10,000 were not those who were fearful and afraid. Bring them down to the water, and I will try them for thee there. And it shall be that of whom I say unto thee, this shall go with thee, the same shall go with thee. And of whomsoever I say unto thee, this shall not go with thee, the same shall not go. So he brought down the people under the water, and the Eternal said unto Gideon, everyone that laps at the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set him by himself, that is, to gather it in his hand and lap it out of his hand. Likewise, everyone that bows down upon his knees to drink, the way most people would do, lower their face into the water. And the number of them that lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men. But all the rest of the people bowed down upon their knees to drink water. Do you think that God could have put it in the mind of these 300 men because they were special? That they were the kind of men that He wanted? You read in the Bible of people who were very adept with various weapons like slingshots. And David is the shining example of that. Because he had lots of practice. Day after day he would be out there slinging stones. It talks, too, about men who could sling stones at a hair's breadth and not miss with a sling. Now, a sling, you know, is not the slingshot that we think of, the little Y made out of hickory or something when we were kids. It was actually a very long strap with a leathern pocket in it. It could be whirled around your head like this, and then you release one part of it, and the rock goes hurling out. And it achieves a velocity about like a 22 bullet, I guess. And very, very fast, and it can certainly penetrate the skull of a human being, which it did in the case of Goliath. Went right between his eyes, sunk into his brain, killed him on the spot. The only place where he wasn't protected. He had a helmet with just this one spot, right atop his nose, bridge of his nose, wasn't protected. And David, who had a lot of practice, but God must have guided him as well. But David was a person who had actually killed a bear and a lion, and had done it with his bare hands. So he was stocky and he was powerful, but his brothers were even bigger than he was. Now here, these people, I think, were chosen of God. It wasn't just willy-nilly or accidental, and perhaps God put it in the minds of them just at the last moment. These 300 would lap, and he said, by the 300 men that lapped, I will save you, verse 7, and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place. So the people took their provender, their victuals, in their hand, and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel back to their tents and retained the 300, and the host of Midian was beneath him in the valley. They're up in the foothills and the mountains. And it came to pass the same night that the Eternal said unto him, arise, get down unto the host, for I have delivered it into your hand. But, really interesting, if you fear to go down, after all of this now, after all that he's seen, the fleece both ways, all the signs from God, if you fear to go down, Go with Phurah, your servant, down to the host, and you shall hear what they say. And afterward shall your hands be strengthened to go down unto the host. Then went he down with Phurah, his servant. That means he was still afraid. He had to be reassured once again. And we tend to be that way. We constantly need reassurance. We need to reassure each other. We need reassurance from the ministry. We need reassurance by a phone call or a card or a letter, because people's faith begins to waver. They back off a little bit. They're having a particular trial. They're not sure they're going to make it through this time. And they're just like Gideon or any other human being who needs to be reassured. And God knew that. And so each time he saw him, that maybe there's some little reluctance here, a little bit of fear, not quite sure, not quite courageous yet. Go down and listen to what they've got to say. So he thought, I better do that. So he went down, and they were sneaking around out there, the armed men, and they just changed the guard. Midianites and Amalekites were all along. The children of the east lay in the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, verse 12. Camels without numbers, the sand of the sea by multitude, probably 150,000, 200,000 of them, who knows. And when Gideon was come, behold, it was a man that told a dream unto his fellow, and said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came unto a tent, and smote it that it fell, and overturned it that the tent lay along, or was fell down, as it should read. And a fellow said, this is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man of Israel. For into his hand has God delivered Midian and all the host. And God caused that to be dreamed and that to be interpreted, and them to go down there, their knees shaking in their boots, wondering if they're going to get discovered and maybe killed on the spot. They overhear this through a tent, and they go back up greatly encouraged. It was so when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof that he worshipped, or as it says, he bowed down in the margin, and returned into the host of Israel, and said, arise, for the Eternal has delivered into your hand the host of Midian. And he divided the 300 men into three companies, 100 each, and put a trumpet in every man's hand with empty pitchers and lamps or torches burning inside the pitchers. So the pitchers would be of clay. They would not be seen except from the top. And they were with the actually like a ram's horn, probably not a brass or a silver trumpet, but a ram's horn, a shofar, and the lamps inside of the pitchers. He said, look on me and do likewise, and behold, when I come to the outside of the camp, it shall be that as I do, so shall you do. When I blow with a trumpet, I and all that are with me, then blow you the trumpets also on every side of all the camp, and say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. They were to shout that out. So Gideon and the 100 men that were with him came into the outside of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch. That was sometime between midnight and 4 a.m. when they would be sound asleep, probably in the wee hours of about 3:30, quarter to 4. And they had but newly set the watch, and they blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers that were in their hands. So all of a sudden, all around this vast army is a lot of shouting and 300 lights. And they don't know, but what every one of the lights is at the helm of hundreds of other men or thousands of them. They're hearing all this noise. The three companies blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers and held the lamps in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands to blow withal. And they cried, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And they stood every man in his place round about the camp. They didn't advance. They just stood there shouting with the torches now in their hands. And the 300 blew the trumpets, and the Eternal set every man's sword against his fellow. So in the chaos, it's pitch dark in the camps. The campfires have long since gone out. The guards are supposed to be way out around the periphery, and all of a sudden they're completely surrounded. All of this noise, all of these lights, they're just seeing shadows everywhere. They grab their swords. People are running. They're thinking that's the enemy, and they're hacking each other to bits. That's the way you love to see enemies get taken down, isn't it? That would be exactly the way I would love to see the next time Iraq attacks somebody or whatever, this kind of thing happen to them. Set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout all the host, and the host fled to Bethshittah in Zerath and to the border of Abel-Meholah unto Tabith, wherever those are, and I don't know on a map, and most of those places do not exist anymore, and you couldn't find them if you tried. And the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali, out of Asher, and all of Manasseh, and pursued after the Midianites. Now the huge pursuit comes with the people who originally had gone home, not just the 300, but a lot more of them. And Gideon sent messengers throughout all Mount Ephraim, saying, Come down against the Midianites, and take before them the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. And all the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together, and took the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. They took two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb, and slew Oreb in the rock, upon the rock Oreb, they named it that, and Zeb at the winepress of Zeb, and pursued Midian, and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of Jordan. Well, you can read the rest of it, how the Ephraimites began to chide him, verse 1 of chapter 8, and how he got off the hook by saying, well, isn't what you did by killing Oreb and Zeb much greater than anything that I was able to do? They were upset, and they were posturing that they should have been there with him in the original battle, and so on. Fantastic example God gives us time and time again of great courage. Now, over in the 2 Chronicles, the 20th chapter, is one of the best examples in all the Bible of that. It reminds me, as you're turning to that, 2 Chronicles 20, of something that was said by Audie Murphy, not by Audie Murphy, but I believe by one of his friends to a tanker who came along. And here was this group in southern Italy, I believe, and the tanker was kind of joshing, talking about the fact that he's on this big Sherman tank, and he said, all I've got between me and enemy bullets is this 1 inch of steel. And the infantryman said, looking up at him, well, all I've got is this shirt I'm wearing. You may remember that scene from that movie. It was called To Hell and Back, and I've seen it probably 3 times. Audie Murphy himself acted in that film, but he actually did those exploits that are portrayed there, and probably a great deal more that we don't know anything about. I think it was a great tragedy when he died in an airplane accident while he was looking at some real estate somewhere. Aero Commander went down and Audie Murphy was aboard it. I remember seeing that cocky young man who was 19 years of age and already an officer in the Army, the most decorated veteran of World War II, the way he saluted the generals when he was out in the parade ground receiving the final medals, the Congressional Medal of Honor. They had a big ceremony and a big parade. And I saw a lot of his motion pictures over the years. Once in a great while, they'll bring one of them back on one of the HBO channels or something. And he reminds me so much of my brother-in-law, Shirley's brother, Tony Hammer, the way he used to look when he was a much younger man. Just quite a resemblance there. In the 20th chapter of 2 Chronicles, it came to pass after this also that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon, with them other beside the Ammonites, came against Jehoshaphat to battle. Then there came some that told Jehoshaphat, saying, There comes this great multitude against you from beyond the sea on this side Syria. And behold, they're in Hazazon-Tamar, which is in En-Gedi. And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek the Eternal and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. Wonderful. Exactly what he should have done. And in a time of great national trauma, that is what presidents used to do. But you cannot imagine, no matter what kind of difficulty this nation got into, I would say that it stretches your credulity beyond belief to think of our present president proclaiming a national day of fasting and prayer because of some great national emergency. Anyway, enough of that. It stretches mine. I don't know about yours. So he did the right thing. He proclaimed a fast throughout all of Judah and set himself to seek God, obviously in prayer. And Judah gathered themselves together to ask help of the Eternal. Even out of all the cities of Judah, they came to seek the Eternal. And Jehoshaphat stood in the congregation of Judah in Jerusalem in the house of the Eternal before the new court, and he uttered this prayer. And it is beautiful. Verses 6 through 12. O Lord God of our fathers, art not thou God in the heaven? And rulest not thou over all the kingdoms of the heathen? And in your hand is there not power and might, so that none is able to withstand thee? I highly recommend to anybody who is facing any kind of problem, whether it's spiritual, financial, whether it is a sickness or a disease, whether it is a family trouble, whether it is some kind of horrible thing, an accident, whatever. Just read this prayer. Make it your own. Pray it yourself. And remember, because oftentimes we forget, we don't say these things to God. Are not you God in heaven? Do not you rule over all the kingdoms of the heathen? And in your hand is there not power and might, so that none is able to withstand thee? Are not you our God who did drive out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and give it to the seed of Abraham, your friend, forever? And they dwelt therein and have built thee a sanctuary therein for your name, saying, if when evil comes upon us as the sword, judgment, some legal problem, some harassment by the law, some illegitimate government interference into your life, or pestilence, some great disease epidemic, or famine, we stand before this house and in your presence, for your name is in this house, and cry unto thee in our affliction, then you will hear and help. And now behold, the children of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom you would not let Israel invade when they came up out of the land of Egypt, but they turned from them and destroyed them not. Behold, I say, how they reward us to come to cast us out of your possession. Didn't say our houses, your possession, which you have given us to inherit. O our God, will not you judge them? For we have no might against this great company that comes against us. We have no might against cancer. We have no might or power against the IRS. We have no might against the abuse of power by an abusive government. We have no might or power against any kind of disease, nor against any demonic spirit. Only God has that power. Neither know we what to do. Have you ever been literally at your wit's end? Because that's what he is saying. We don't know what to do. People get to the point where, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to turn, where to go, what to do. Well, here's what to do. But our eyes are upon thee. Now, if your eyes are focused upon the enemy, that's what's in your mind. If your eyes are on what the doctor says the problem is, that's what's on your mind. If your eyes are on your little tiny bank account with too many bills to pay, that's what you're focusing on. If your eyes are on the problem is overwhelming you. But if you forget the problem because God is far bigger than that problem and hundreds more like it and far bigger problems than that, and say, our eyes are upon thee. Now look what they did. All Judah stood before the Eternal with their little ones, their wives, and their children. A family gathering. And you think people's minds are not upon their wives and their children in a time like that? Here is a vast army, armed to the teeth, with the ugliest kind of swords and spears and javelins and pikes and clubs that you can imagine. And this would be something that we could only understand if we had been in maybe Czechoslovakia or Poland or maybe Hungary or France in the lowlands or in Denmark or somewhere, and the Germans were coming. But it was certainly real for them. Then upon Jehaziel, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benaniah, the son of Jeiel, the son of Mattaniah, a Levite of the sons of Asaph, came the Spirit of the Eternal in the midst of the congregation, and he said, hearken ye, all Judah, and you inhabitants of Jerusalem, and you King Jehoshaphat, thus saith the Eternal unto you. And so God answered the prayer by a human agent who told them what God was answering. Be not afraid nor dismayed by reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. Not your battle. And there are battles in this life, whether it is something that the church faces together as a threat, or whether it is an individual problem in your life where you need to turn over the battle, turn over the problem to God, and put the responsibility where it lies. It is not your struggle, but God's. Actually, the best news you could ever hear, only God can save him now. What do you mean only? That was true from the beginning. Only God can save anybody. Now, I know that medical science can do certain things, and I'm not going to in any way gainsay that, because I know that that is true. And I've seen people who have survived operations for cancer from a lung or things of that nature, have had a disease that would have killed them if the cancer was not cut out and caught in time, and they've had many, many years added to their lives. So I'm not going to say that cannot be done. But if God Almighty, and I do know there have been cases where people have been healed of cancer where it had been absolutely diagnosed and it was just gone. And if people will trust God, it is, I think, according to the faith of the individual. I really do. As Christ said, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? And I know we're the most faithless generation, with more of Satan's jangling world around to intrude into our consciousness all the time that keeps us away from thoughts of God, that we don't have anywhere near the kind of faith that people of old did have. But I do know that if we have that faith, according to your faith, be it unto you, that as Jesus Christ of Nazareth said, if any man have faith as a grain of a mustard seed, he can say to this mountain, be you removed, and it shall be done. And Jesus Christ said, whatsoever you ask in my name, I will do it unto you. And it's according to his name and according to his will. So the battle is not yours, but God's. You can read all the rest of this, verse 23 through 27. The children of Ammon and Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir to utterly slay and destroy them. And they helped destroy one another. The same thing happened as in the case of Gideon. They rose up against each other, slaughtered one another. The Israelites go out there with a song on their lips. They march toward this enemy singing. They go out there and there's nothing but dead men and all kinds of gold and jewelry and amulets and tremendous spoils for them to gather. So not only do they overcome the evil, but God turns the lemons into lemonade and they receive a great outpouring of wealth in addition to the army being destroyed before them. So think of this. Maybe the current problem, maybe the current battle is not only to be won, but maybe at the other end of it is a great blessing beyond anything you can begin to imagine. That once the battle is over, there is a great blessing which is going to come. Well, that 15 people that showed up on that rainy night, very different from what happened to me a couple of years ago when I went down to Panama City Beach and saw about 600 people in that beautiful auditorium the first year we were in the boardwalk. And I'll never forget the way I felt when I walked in there. My wife and I were hardly able to take a breath. And I stood up in that pulpit and looked out. I had no idea of going to say this. I merely looked at them and I said, thank God you're here. Well, now it is 2000 and we have four fee sites in the United States. And at least the survey letter that we sent out indicated that about 700 are going to come to Lexington. And in a very short while now, God willing, I will be traveling around and visiting with all of these people in four different sites in the United States. This last week and a half or so, I have finished four sermons. I did one for the Feast of Trumpets, which will be played in churches here and around the world on trumpets, which is next week. And then I did one for the Day of Atonement, which will be on the 10th day of the 7th month. And I did one for the first of the Feast of Tabernacles, the first day, and also one for the last great day. So I've already had practice sermons, and Mark has got them sent out to all the areas around the world. There are going to be some places where only perhaps a family or 6 or 8 or 10 people or 3 or 5 people will be there. Other places where perhaps 15 or 20 or 30 or 50 will be there. But people here in Australia and all around the world will be seeing those sermons while we're hearing from a live preacher in a pulpit at the various feast site, wherever it is you go. I want to conclude by asking, how much power does God have? I know I've seen a lot of men's power, and I've been very impressed by it. I guess one of the most impressive things that I remember from my life was the morning when I heard the captain of our aircraft carrier announce over the loudspeaker that as people who were off duty could have an opportunity to come up to the flight deck, they might like to see all the other ships that we had joined during the night. Well, I was only one deck below the flight deck in what's called the op shop or the optical shop because I was in the gunnery department, and that's where they did the repair work on all of the various 40 millimeter quads and all their sights and the radars and everything. And it was kind of a hangout place for the fire control, not putting out fires, but the fire of the guns division. So just a few steps and I was on the flight deck and I looked around, and right over there was the battleship. I think that one was the Iowa. There were two battleships, I think the Missouri and the Iowa. There were several heavy cruisers. There were about 23 destroyers. There were submarines. There were two other aircraft carriers, the Essex and the Bonhomme Richard. I was aboard the Antietam. And here was the entire 7th Fleet stretching to the horizon, and a feeling of power and of pride. Now, I'm just a young, completely unconverted sailor in the Navy, but a feeling of that massed firepower and all those hundreds of airplanes just absolutely stood my little old white cap up on my head. And I'll never forget the way that felt. I felt like I was part of something very powerful. But I'll never forget when I was down at Cape Kennedy, and I saw men go to the moon in the Saturn rocket. And I was there only 3 miles away. You might think that's a long way. Well, when you're looking at a 36-story high rocket, that has 7 million pounds of thrust. And you know that little thing at the tip of it carries a capsule full of men with a lunar lander and everything aboard it. And then when you actually feel the earth rocking and your body shaking and the change in your pocket is bouncing up and down and you're trying to keep your voice and not have your breath taken away and do a television description of what you're seeing at the same time, that is power, human power, the power of the rocket propulsion fuel that they had in there. And I was just absolutely dumbfounded. But you know, Jesus Christ came back to his disciples, Matthew 28:18-20, and he said, "All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth." And the Greek word is dunamis, dynamic power. "Go you therefore," because of this, "go you therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age. Amen. I will never leave you nor forsake you. I am with you always," Jesus Christ said. This is part of his church. He is with us. His eyes are upon us. There is no problem Satan can throw at us, not a demonic problem, not some legal problem, not the federal government or any of its agencies, not a state or a county government, no disease, no sickness, no financial problem, no family trouble that can even begin to compare with the problems that faced Israel when men whom God had said, "Be strong and of good courage," went out sometimes with nothing but a shirt, a clay pot, and a shofar, or with a song on their lips. And the enemy just fell down before them dead. And so it is that every problem we face will disappear, and a great bountiful blessing is right behind it. So, be thou strong and of good courage.